It's the Science Times podcast for Tuesday, September 9th. I'm David Corcoran of the New York Times. This week, friendly invaders, watching the brain as it relives memories, and traveling mammoths. First, the science headlines with Katherine Herzog.
A study published in the journal Nature says that the strongest hurricanes and typhoons have become even stronger over the past 20 years. However, more typical, smaller storms did not become more dangerous over the same period. The lead author of the study says that global warming is one reason. Dr. James Elsner from Florida State University says he expects to see more Category 4 and 5 hurricanes in the coming years. There have been 10 named storms in the Atlantic so far this hurricane season, which lasts until the end of November. A piece of ice shelf nearly the size of Manhattan broke off Canada's Ellesmere Island in the northern Arctic last month. That piece had been a part of the ice shelf for nearly 4,500 years. Scientists say it just disappeared, revealing the rapid changes taking place in the Arctic. In his .Earth blog, the New York Times' Andrew Revkin looked into reports that edges of the Arctic ice cap have entirely detached from land, allowing ships to now circumnavigate the cap. But officials at the National Ice Center say it's not possible. In some places, what looks like open water in satellite images are actually ponds of meltwater on top of the ice. And the influenza vaccine is losing its reputation as an effective way to ward off the virus in the elderly. A growing number of immunologists say the vaccine probably does not work very well for people over age 70, the group that accounts for 3/4 of all flu deaths. And those are some of this week's science headlines. I'm Katherine Herzog of New York Times Radio.
Our lead story in Science Times this week is a new look at an old menace, invasive species. You've heard of kudzu, of course, and the European starling, which was imported in the 19th century by somebody who thought the U.S. should have at least one of every bird mentioned by Shakespeare, and now it pretty much owns the place. But invasive species are not all, well, invasive. Science writer Carl Zimmer reports on the work of scientists who have come to some surprising conclusions about their role in ecology and evolution. One of those scientists is Professor Dov Sachs of Brown University, and he joins us now. Dr. Sachs, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So the conventional wisdom here can, I think, be summed up in six words: native species good, invasive species bad. Your paper challenges that wisdom.
It does. I think I might recast that a tiny bit. I might say that people generally think of invasive species as bad, but they also tend to think of biodiversity as good. And I think there's a conflict then between some of the patterns of plant introductions we've seen around the world, where non-native plants are adding to the total sort of net biological diversity within given regions, such that the biodiversity of the region is going up, which most people would argue is a good thing, but that's occurring because of invasive plants, which most people would argue is a bad thing. And so I think how we reconcile that conflict has a lot to do with some of the nuances to understanding species invasions.
Well, this is interesting because people think of invasive species as driving out biodiversity and making things less diverse by just sort of taking over. I take it, though, that that's not always what happens.
You know, it's an interesting thing. Part of the nuance that's important is that the spatial scale that you look at this problem at is really important. So globally, non-native species or invasive species are having a pretty obvious net effect, and that is that they're causing a global decline in biodiversity. At local scales, let's say at the scale of an acre of land someplace, the impact that non-native species are having is probably more variable. So in some places, invasive plants may be actually increasing total plant diversity, and in other places, they may be decreasing it. It's at the regional scales with plants that we probably see the most consistent patterns, and that's maybe at the scale of an island nation like New Zealand or a place like the United States even, or a state like New York.
Well, you studied New Zealand, so let's talk about that.
In New Zealand, there are approximately 2,000 different native plant species that are indigenous, and about 2,000 non-native plants have been introduced and now grow on their own without human assistance in New Zealand. And there's been very few plant extinctions in New Zealand. So we've basically gone from 2,000 native plants, we've added 2,000 naturalized plant species, and so we've about doubled the total number of plant species living in New Zealand.
New Zealand is actually a richer place for these colonizations.
It's an interesting thing, and part of the interesting thing, of course, is the differences we see between different taxonomic groups. So we've had massive extinctions, for instance, of bird species in New Zealand.
Let's talk about animals for a minute and maybe look at a couple of cases here in the United States that are famous. The invasions of different kinds of mussels on the hulls of cargo ships in the Great Lakes, that's been really destructive, hasn't it?
It surely has. It's caused a huge economic burden to people that need to clean the hulls or clean the intake valves or power plants. And the zebra mussels have actually caused, as far as we can tell, pretty large significant ecological impacts as well. One of the things that's starting to become apparent is that there may be some fundamental differences between how plants and animals, when they invade an area, impact their environment. Now, certainly there are some plants that have huge impacts. So we could think about kudzu in the southeast,
sure,
or ice plants in California. These things can completely change habitat and can drastically drop biodiversity at local spatial scales and have big impacts. But what they don't seem to be doing, at least so far, is causing species extinctions.
Should we make a distinction, though, between plants and animals?
Well, I think we should, because they have very different impacts, at least over the time scales that we've been looking at. And one of the big open questions with plant invasions is, although the impacts they've had, for instance, on species extinction have been limited to date, is that going to change? If we wait another couple hundred years, is that the amount of time it's going to take for some of these impacts to actually be realized? And that's an open and sort of unresolved question right now, but is an active area of research, and hopefully within the next few years, we'll be able to shed more light on that question.
Do your findings have any bigger implications for governments and policymakers and the general public? I mean, I take it you would argue for a much more nuanced view of species invasion, but is there something that people should be doing or thinking differently?
On the one hand, yes. On the other hand, no. I think the big picture and the big message is the probably safest thing to do is just to prevent as many biological invasions as you can. And so to the extent that there's legislation in different countries that tries to prevent the import of new species that may become invaders, I think that that's probably a wise policy decision. What's unclear and which needs additional work is, are there actually cases where some of these invaders might actually be beneficial for native species, or for native ecosystems, or for the services those systems provide? And there's some reasons to think that in certain circumstances, some of these non-native species may actually be beneficial. And that's something that hasn't been looked at in a lot of depth yet.
Dr. Dov Sachs teaches ecology and evolutionary biology at Brown. His work is featured in Carl Zimmer's lead article in Science Times this week on friendly invaders. Dr. Sachs, many thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
Now here's reporter John Schwartz with the Science Minute.
Researchers have actually seen people's brains forming memories. In a startling paper in the current edition of the journal Science, researchers in Israel and the University of California, Los Angeles had 13 epilepsy patients who were about to undergo brain surgery watch some video clips. In preparation for their surgery, the patients had tiny electrodes threaded into their brains to help track down the source of their seizures. The video snippets included animal movies, The Simpsons, Seinfeld, and other programs. As the subjects watched, the researchers monitored the electrodes in areas of the brain known as the hippocampus, which seems to have a lot to do with recording new memories, and the entorhinal cortex, and noted the firings of individual neurons. A few minutes later, the researchers asked the patients about the clips, and the very same neurons fired up a couple of seconds before the subjects described them. That suggests that, to the brain, recalling things might be a lot like seeing them for the first time. The neurons, by the way, seem to fire most excitedly for The Simpsons and Seinfeld. The researchers didn't explain why this might be, but the underlying message might just be that even individual neurons like a good laugh. For the Science Times podcast, I'm John Schwartz.
We're joined, as always, by Henry Fountain, our observatory columnist, and by Jim Gorman, the editor of Science Times. So, Henry, this week, woolly mammoths.
Yes, specifically sort of the travels of the woolly mammoth.
This is one of my favorite creatures, but just kind of remind us.
It's one of your favorite creatures and one of your favorite extinct creatures because, as we know, they went extinct roughly 8,000 years ago, although I guess there was a population of smaller mammoths that survived until about 2000 BC. Like most animals and humans, the thinking is that they traveled up through Eurasia and then across a land bridge that existed where the Bering Sea is now, and then came down and populated North America. In the mammoth's case, pretty much northern North America, the Arctic area. And that's, you know, that's a common and widely accepted idea for all sorts of animals and humans. Of course, there are some animals that went back, like the relatives of the camels and the horses. In this case, these researchers have found by analyzing lots and lots of samples of mammoth DNA, something like 150 samples of DNA from dead mammoths, they found that at one point the mammoths actually went back, went westbound at least one point, maybe a couple of times.
In other words, back towards Siberia from where Alaska is now.
Right. Yeah. And in fact, what they did by this sort of genetic analysis, they discovered that the mammoths that became extinct in Siberia around 10,000 years ago were actually not really Siberian mammoths anymore. They were the North American mammoths who had repopulated Siberia.
I have a question, though.
Certainly.
Woolly mammoths. Are there non-woolly, unwoolly, naked mammoths?
You know, that's a good question. I believe they are. They might be called elephants, actually.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, really?
Jim, turning to you, more ancient times. This is northern Arizona, right?
Well, it's in the southwest. A lot of the pictures of the rock art that we're talking about is from northern Arizona.
I've seen the pictures of this rock art, and it's pretty stunning. Tell us about it.
Well, there's a retired linguistics professor, Eckhart Malutke, who became entranced with rock art and takes these stunning photographs of rock art. He concentrates on very old carvings in rock, which are apparently, according to some academics, composed of 15 so-called phosphenes that are squiggles, dots, zigzags, grids, very simple patterns that are found globally in all primitive art. And when you see the pictures of them, you see that they're quite exquisite looking. They're really amazing. And apparently he goes all over the Southwest and risks life and limb to get these photographs.
Jim Gorman is the editor of Science Times, and Henry Fountain is our observatory columnist. Gentlemen, as always, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And that's the Science Times podcast for Tuesday, September 9th. Thanks for downloading us. We'll be back next week. I'm David Corcoran of The New York Times.